This is Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Carol Masser. Welcome to the Bloomberg Business Week Weekend Podcast. In this episode, we're going to bring you news of the week, insights from the magazine, and more.
This week, Carol, Elon Musk. Can't get enough of that guy.
Right. When we're talking Elon Musk and Tesla, we often talk about unusual stories. This one is more unusual than usual.
And we take you to China to help figure out what it takes to be a pop star there.
That, too, is a bit unusual, but it's a fascinating story, and it's a huge music market. Plus, Facebook. It's this week's cover story. Hard to believe, a year from that Cambridge Analytica scandal. And yet, there's lots of questions about what changes have really come internally at the company.
Privacy, what does it mean? What does it mean to Facebook? And
right.
How much does Facebook actually care? But first, Carol, the biggest story of the week, it's got to be Boeing.
Boeing's 737 MAX 8 nightmare. Two catastrophic crashes, 346 people killed, and flyers across the globe taking to social media to express their fears about the plane's safety. Editor Jim Ellis is with us. So, Jim, Boeing, no doubt about it, our big company story this week, our big stock story this week, and the ending still yet to be determined. Big story.
Boeing. I mean, this is a company that was doing everything right. I mean, ever since they got a new CEO about 4 years ago, Dennis Muilenburg, and he had managed to basically ride up the value of Boeing to unseen levels. I mean, revenues were sort of clicking away, $100 billion a year. This was a company where not only were they doing everything right, but also one of their main competitors, Airbus, was in all sorts of trouble. There's a big bribery scandal that was sort of holding back, had a lot of management changes. And there was also the A380, their big super jumbo that basically had to be shut down. So everyone said, wow, Boeing is doing great, and it has this wonderful plane called the 737 MAX, which is an update of the venerable 737, which started back in the 1960s.
Right, it's been around for a while.
It's been around forever, but they've been able to continually upgrade it. And this latest upgrade was really exactly the plane that people want nowadays. It's much more fuel efficient. It's about 14% more fuel efficient than previous generations, and that is what the hot thing for new carriers, for low-cost carriers, and for established carriers that want to compete with low-cost carriers. So everybody wanted one.
Right.
And so what they ended up doing was they have an order book of 5,000 of these. You know, that is a huge amount.
Did I hear something like $600
billion
of orders are now at risk?
$600 orders are at risk now because, as people say, if this plane isn't, at least it's not guaranteed to be safe, a lot of purchasers are saying, maybe I want to rethink. And some are even saying, now I want to cancel my order.
It was an interesting story, and it was kind of a bit of a controversial one, right? As so many countries led by China around the world, the European region, ultimately Canada, were grounding the plane before the FAA finally here in the United States ruled in and said, okay, we got to ground this plane.
That's a much different situation than we normally have. Most times people wait on the FAA and sometimes the EU to decide on what safety the issues should be acted upon. In this case, you know, the day after the crash, China jumped up and said, no, we're not going to have our airlines, you know, fly the 737 MAX anymore. Right now, they account for about a third of all the MAXs that have been delivered or to the Chinese airlines.
I think about Business Week, we do so many different company stories here, deep dives, and I do think about companies that have been in trouble before. It could be BP, Exxon with the oil spill many years ago. I do think about the corporate reputation for Boeing and also the future of the company in that they didn't maybe kind of get out ahead of this before other countries did.
Yeah, they completely lost control of the narrative here. Instead of talking about the software fix that they supposedly have for what people think
almost
might be
being defensive to some extent.
Yeah, they sort of said, hey, there's nothing wrong with this. And then as one country after another not only said their airlines couldn't fly the plane, but they also said they closed their airspace to the plane. And you could see where this was headed, but Boeing was sort of last to see it. And finally, after having the FAA say there's no problem, and after the president giving mixed signals, finally on Wednesday, the president said, enough, we're going to basically ground the plane as well.
Right, because the media, we all reported on how the president had a conversation with the CEO of Boeing, and it took some time before we actually got that grounding.
Well, that's one of the issues that for some of the sort of international carriers, they're wondering whether the company was so close to the government here in the U.S. that might be a reason that they were slow to ground the plane.
It also may be a reason, perhaps, that we haven't gotten the black box back to the United States. And that was a little bit of a hot potato, right? Germany said, we don't want the black box. It ended up in France.
Yeah, normally what happens is people are very happy to send the black box back to the U.S., which has a lot of experience handling sort of this sort of forensic of looking at a crash. But in this case, the Ethiopians were saying, we don't know. We think that it ought to go to Europe.
Yeah.
That was sort of a slap, because that sort of suggests that they worried that there would not be, let's just say, as truthful.
Regulators too in bed, perhaps, with the company?
That was it. A little too close.
One last thing I want to get, and I feel like this is how the magazine was really smart in covering it, in social media really played a role. Consumers saying, I want to know what plane I'm flying, and pushing back.
There was a lot more of that than we typically get. What I think part of it is simply because this plane is such a workhorse, since it's on order by so many carriers around the world. What happened then is that social media posts were out there, and it sort of fed on itself. We also ended up with newspapers outside the U.S. that were jumping here. A couple of British tabloids dubbed this the death plane.
That's editor Jim Ellis. And Carol, what I really loved about your chat with him was you talked about the historical perspective. You talked about what happened this week, obviously, a lot, and where it goes from here.
Jason, it was a big story on so many different levels. That includes the stock. Boeing shares, they wiped out about $40 billion worth of market cap this week.
Jason, safe to say it's not unusual to read an unusual story about Tesla and its co-founder and CEO Elon Musk. However, this story this week in the magazine about Tesla and Musk is more unusual than normal when it comes to Mr. Musk.
It is indeed. Zeke Fox with us here in New York. Take us inside the Gigafactory, because you really got inside it through these two whistleblowers.
So the Gigafactory is Tesla's giant battery factory. It's in a desert industrial park outside Reno. It's really the middle of nowhere, and it's one of the biggest buildings in the world. And this was key for Musk ramping up to build 5,000 Model 3 cars a week, which was his big goal. So we spoke to some whistleblowers who worked there who had some crazy stories about what went on.
Such as?
So it all started last June 4th. This story appeared in Business Insider, and it said that there are huge amounts of waste, that there were wasted parts piled up high all around the factory, and that Tesla was perhaps using damaged batteries in its cars. From reading the story, it was clear that there was some sort of whistleblower who had gone to Business Insider.
Complete with pictures, which comes into the story later.
Yes. So he'd sent her pictures. He'd sent her data from Tesla systems. This was all clear from reading between the lines. And the story was, you know, there's so many crazy things going on with Tesla. People basically moved on right away. It didn't make a huge splash.
Another day, another story, another crazy story on Tesla.
But what we found out is that for Elon Musk, he wasn't ready to move on. He was really angry that anyone would leak. And he actually hired a special team of operatives to track down this leaker.
All right. So I want to talk about the operatives, because as I was reading this story, you sort of it takes a little bit of a left turn and you start to talk about Uber a little bit. And I thought, OK, this is interesting. Zeke and Matt, where are you taking me here? And then it becomes very clear how Uber figures into it, because it is this squad.
Mm-hmm. So Uber had a intelligence team, and one of the members of the team blew the whistle on Uber. And he said that his colleagues were spying on people, recording rival executives' conversations, hacking into their databases. Now, he later took some of this back, but there was enough there that the CEO apologized. And the head lawyer said, Uber employees, stop following people around. So the members of this team, several of them, sued the whistleblower for defaming them. And they said, this is going to make it hard for us to get a job. But it didn't. As soon as this came out, they got jobs at Tesla.
Because most people probably read this and thought, oh my gosh, this is really bad behavior. But Elon Musk apparently read it and said, those are my guys.
There you go. And so here's where they came into play. So this whistleblower, they wanted to track him down, and they were able to work backwards to figure out that his computer was the only one that had accessed the right combination of numbers to leak the numbers to Business Insider. Because there's thousands of people in this Gigafactory.
Right.
Like, you wouldn't even have time to, like, search through everyone's, well, they don't have access to everyone's personal emails.
Wasn't there something, though, about the pictures he took, too, that they were able to figure out who was able to do that?
So the pictures helped them place, like, the location where the leaker likely was, so that narrowed it down.
And then they could essentially look at the security cameras and say, this was a guy who was there at this particular time, as I understood it.
Yes. Now, I mean, the crazy part comes, though, after they caught the guy. So they've identified the leaker. It's Martin Tripp. He's, like, basically a low-level assembly line junior engineer. And they interrogate him for hours. He admits to it. He gets fired. Tesla sues him. And then he starts exchanging emails with Elon Musk. He says, you know, this is what you've done is terrible. You're a bad person. I mean, most CEOs, right? Probably let it go.
Like they delete, they forward, whatever.
We wouldn't go near any of this stuff.
No, Musk just writes right back like, no, you're the terrible person. Like you're going to get what's coming to you. And then the leaker says, no, you'll get what's coming to you or whatever. And now here's where it really gets weird.
It's almost
just
unbelievable.
A few hours after that, the local sheriff gets a call from the Gigafactory. It's one of Tesla's security guys. And Tesla's security guy seems really worried. He says, we've just had a threat called in. We heard that this guy, Martin Tripp, this whistleblower, he's coming to shoot us up. And can you send guards? Like, we don't have guns. Like, help us, help us. And so the sheriff goes to investigate, and he finds that the threat is bogus.
Well, doesn't it get to Tripp? And Tripp is totally nervous and like, wait a minute, what's
Tripp's
going
like
on
at here? A casino.
Yeah.
He finds Tripp at a casino where he's gone to sort of hide from the press because his address was posted online. And the whistleblower tells the sheriff, no, of course not. Like the sheriff says he's crying.
Yeah.
And
they find him credible that he's not going to shoot up the factory.
And Tripp even says maybe Elon Musk called in this fake tip. So the Tripp's life, I mean, he fled to Hungary after this. He says his lawyer says his life is ruined. And meanwhile, after this tip is discredited, after the sheriff says it's not true, Tesla calls reporters and says, hey guys, did you hear there was a shooting threat at our factory? It was that whistleblower guy. He sure seems crazy. Just in the corporate world, this is so bizarre that you would publicize a shooting threat that no one would have known about if you hadn't. Even on the day of the threat, while the sheriff was trying to find the whistleblower, Elon Musk was emailing reporters himself and saying, we just had this threat. It's this whistleblower.
Amazing. So you have these, as you pointed out, you essentially have whistleblowers effectively on both sides of this issue in a lot of ways. Where does it go from here?
Yeah, so this brings us to Sean Guthrow, who was one of the security managers at the Gigafactory. And he's actually the guy who called the sheriff to tell the sheriff about the threat. And now he's been fired, and he's saying he's turned whistleblower himself. And he's saying that him and his colleagues on the security team went too far in their pursuit of Tripp.
Right.
He's saying that they had Tripp followed by private investigators. They misled the police about that. They were somehow able to monitor his communications to see, because Elon Musk had this theory that Tripp was working with hedge funds, short sellers, oil companies, that there was some sort of big conspiracy going on, and he really wanted his security team to find evidence of that.
That's reporter Zeke Fox, and fascinating story. I feel like a day doesn't go by that we don't talk about Elon Musk and Tesla, but this story more unusual than normal.
Deeply reported and really takes you inside the mind and obviously the Twitter account and talks about the real ramifications of how this company is run.
Jason, so becoming a pop star in China, apparently not like becoming a pop star elsewhere.
Don't I know it.
Yeah, exactly. So following the trail of the pop singer who is working on conquering China, let's bring in Lucas Shaw. You went to China. You found this individual, Christopher Nissen. I have no idea who he is. Who is he?
He is a pop star from Denmark, grew up in a suburb of Copenhagen, and had this kind of rapid ascent in his home country. You know, got signed when he was 17. He just walked into a record label, started performing. They liked him so much, they gave him a deal. His second album, which came out in 2014, won Pop Album of the Year at the Danish Music Awards. He had all these number one songs. And at that moment, he was convinced that he was kind of on his way to becoming one of the biggest pop stars in the world, or at the very least, he hoped that that was what was going to happen. But then when he tried to kind of test the waters outside of Denmark, he went to Germany, he went to Norway, he didn't have much success, nothing happened. But around the same time, he found out that one of his songs had started to really kind of make it big in China, and he started to go there in 2014. And so since 2014, though he, to your point, is pretty much unknown in the US, the UK, Germany, Japan, the world's biggest music markets, he's had 8 number one songs in China.
So I want to get to the potential for the Chinese music market, Lucas. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit more about who he is. I'm going to read just a couple great lines from your story. He looks as if he walked off the assembly line from some global pop star factory, which in some case he did. We should also tell people he has been referred to as the Danish Justin Bieber. So just to set the context of who this guy is, and he is blowing up in China.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. When I went to one of his shows in Shanghai, I was talking to his manager, who had started at his record label and then had left and started a management company and signed Christopher to that company. He was kind of expressing frustration that Christopher can wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, having gotten no sleep, and look better than he would if he had spent all day being prepped in the makeup chair. Christopher just, you know, he's got blonde hair, blue eyes, got the strong jaw. He just looks like somebody that people dream of. And to that point, at this show in Shanghai, the people who showed up early who wanted to wait for him, it was all young women between the ages of, say, 17 and 25. And they all dream of being close to him.
So, all right. So what is it about the Chinese market that makes him so appealing that he isn't necessarily translating to other parts of the world?
So part of it is that China still loves really traditional pop music in a way that most of the markets in the West have sort of moved away from. A lot of pop that's successful now, you fold in some kind of like hip-hop beats or some dance music, you combine some of these other genres that have really taken over culture over the past 10 years. But a lot of the biggest musicians, not just in China, but across much of Asia, are kind of Mando pop stars, K-pop stars, Kanto pop stars, J-pop stars, so Japan, Cantonese, Mandarin, and traditional pop in different languages. So that is one advantage for him. And then the other thing is just China is such an unproven market at this point that you're almost everybody, unless you're Taylor Swift or Adele or Bruno Mars, you're starting from square one. And Christopher just chose to put in the effort in a way that very few artists do because it's hard to make money out of the gate.
Well, and part of the effort, and you described this so beautifully in your story, is really being up for anything because the publicity circuit is not just about showing up and asking and answering some friendly questions from Jimmy Fallon or Stephen Colbert or James Corden. You really get put through quite the, I might say, humiliating ringer there as you make the rounds.
Yeah, and it's not just from the, you know, from the TV shows or the streaming services that are doing it. There are a couple aspects of it. One is that there's this kind of group of society in China called the KOLs or key online influencers. They're who we'd think of as social media influencers, and making a bunch of stops with them is now a key part of any publicity tour for any musician. And so they want you to do all sorts of silly things because they're trying to entertain their fans. But even Warner Music Group, which is this company, they sent me a video that he had taped while visiting China for them. And he's sitting there and he's having to pronounce and kind of try all sorts of weird Chinese foods while also reading letters from his fans. So on the one moment, he's got a fan telling them how much they love him. And then he's eating like slimy, sticky fish that he doesn't know what to do with.
Oh, my God. Yeah. So listen, let's also talk about, though, in general, the music industry in China. It's very restricted, right? Foreign artists have to get a visa to actually perform there. I mean, there are tight controls on all of it.
And many have been banned.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a very long list of top acts that are not allowed to perform there. Bjork, Bon Jovi, Katy Perry, Justin Bieber, it's all for different reasons. Some of them have said something about Taiwan, which is a point of conflict with China. Some of them have voiced support for independence movement in Tibet, or just if you wish the Dalai Lama happy birthday, you're probably not going to be able to perform in China for the next 10 years. Justin Bieber was an ambiguous bad behavior, but talking to some of the big music promoters in China, you know, the restrictions and on what you need to do in order to play there are pretty severe. You know, it comes down to not just submitting everything that you're going to say, because there is no spontaneity in musical performance in China, because the Chinese regulators want to know every facet of a performance because they see the potential power of music. And you've seen restrictions on what you can and can't say in China get a lot worse.
That's reporter Lucas Shaw. I love this, Carol, because we sent him to Hong Kong for a few months, and he came back with this story among many others.
Right. It talks about the Chinese music market, how big it is, and what it takes to become a pop star in that market.
So, Jason, it's been a year chock full of concerns and questions about Facebook's responsibility for policing its online services.
And I feel like they're big continuing existential questions around this company. Sarah Fryer all over it, as always. Great piece in the magazine this week, breaking down the latest. You start this story in Sri Lanka, Sarah. Take us there.
So about a year ago in Sri Lanka, there was this outpouring of violence that was really sparked by fake news that spread on Facebook. And Facebook at the time, and even for the many years leading up to this moment, didn't really have the infrastructure in place to take those concerns and deal with them, because they didn't have the right language resources, or they didn't have the right understanding of the cultural tensions in Sri Lanka. So they just ignored what was going on in this country for many years until the government shut Facebook down, and that was a wake-up call for them, and they realized that it didn't really fit into something that they knew how to deal with. So Facebook does what Facebook does when they have a new thing they have to deal with, which is create a rule to be able to deal with it in the future. It's a very sort of corporate structural way of responding to crises. They wanted to bring us into this system, invited me to Menlo Park to talk to a lot of their executives who work on the system of creating rules to address problems with how their users communicate.
Sarah, talk to us about the rules. It's 27 pages. It's called the Community Standards at Facebook. What exactly do they say? What do they lay out here?
So in Sri Lanka, the problem was that misinformation on Facebook is totally allowed, but there wasn't a rule against misinformation that would spark violence. And so they came up with an exception to their overarching rule. And we see this over and over in how Facebook handles problems. For example, when the Tide Pod challenge was going on and teens were swallowing Tide Pods, they had several meetings at Facebook to try to figure out, should we allow people to do something that could cause them bodily harm? Should we allow that content on our platform? And so that is just the structure with which they like to deal with this, because they have thousands of moderators around the world, not enough, some critics say, but 15,000 people who are looking through this content that users flag and that they're AI flags in saying, should this be allowed on Facebook or should this not be allowed? Taking it down in some cases. And in some cases, responding and saying, this does not violate our terms, even though the user is like, yes, it does. I read your rules. This is against the rules. Why are you leaving it up? It's a broken system.
So, Sarah, one of the really interesting points of your piece is it gets to this notion that Facebook ultimately doesn't have an incentive to change the rules, because changing the rules could ultimately be bad for business. And you talk about how critics say that too slow, quote unquote, is a euphemism for deliberately ignoring a problem until someone important complains. Help us understand how they are walking, or maybe not walking, this fine line.
I want to bring us back to 1 year ago, almost to the day, when the news about Cambridge Analytica broke. The company for years had known about that problem too. But until the media wrote about it, and until senators and congressmen started calling Facebook on Facebook to do something, that's when they had to formulate a plan. And we've seen that pattern over and over in Sri Lanka with Cambridge Analytica, with the opioid crisis on Instagram. This is a company that really starts to step it up and respond once there is public pressure to do so. And then in that case, they will say, you know, we took the, one of Zuckerberg's lines is we now have a broader view of our responsibility. And this story is really about like what that broader view entails. And if it's still a very reactionary posture that Facebook is taking.
Well, talk to us about the folks you talked to at Facebook specifically. Monica Bickert, she's their head of global policy management. And you caught up with her. What does she say about Facebook's ability to police its platform and about its willingness to police its platform?
I found Monica Bickert very earnest in trying to solve this problem. I mean, there's only so much that she can do with the resources she's given to deal with the content of 2.7 billion users across all these platforms who are posting, you know, billions of things a day. And she is trying to work with what she's got. But, you know, if you have 15,000 moderators, that's still, you know, one moderator per 250,000 or more users on Facebook. So that's like not the best ratio to have to deal with.
But you know what I want to jump
she's
in.
She's trying to make it systemic. Yeah.
Sarah, let me jump in for a second. But do they have a point? Because I think about we're so critical of what goes on in China in terms of you know,
Censorship,
excuse me.
Right.
Of that going on there that, you know, what is the line that something like a Facebook or any social media platform has to follow in order of kind of letting people do their own thing, right, without policing it too much? Freedom
of
speech.
That's the same central debate that they're having right now at Facebook. How much can we really decide that we want our platform to not have this kind of content? And how much is overreach? You know, if we say that this information is likely to spark violence, should it be Facebook that's saying that? Or should it be, you know, some outside groups who really have the expertise? And in that case, they decided it shouldn't be Facebook, that they should bring on outside groups. Of course, that makes responding to the content slower. But the trade-off is that mm-hmm. you'd have a single company making all these decisions. And so Mark Zuckerberg has said that he thinks that's not even sustainable from his point of view, that in the future, he wants Facebook to just not be in charge of this in the end game. And he's going to appoint this outside board of people from diverse disciplines. We don't really know that much about this board. We just know there's going to be like 40 people on it who make the final call on these decisions about content on Facebook who are not affiliated with the company.
So, Sarah, I want to ask you about the recent news, the recent long post that Mark Zuckerberg made that either hinted at, depending on your perspective, or actually laid out a very different future for Facebook. What's your read? What's the read of people who follow the company closely about what it means for Facebook as a company going forward and what it means for Facebook users in terms of the product that they'll see?
So from my perspective on this content story, if you're thinking about that problem specifically, content moderation only works if you can actually see the content. And what Zuckerberg wrote about in his vision for the future of Facebook is that they would build more encrypted services. So services that were so privacy secure that not even Facebook could see the content that users were writing. And Zuckerberg himself acknowledged that that could contribute to maybe a safer place for terrorists, child pornographers, the sort of the worst of the worst on Facebook to thrive. But he said there are trade-offs with privacy and people are very concerned about their data. Now, to poke holes in that a little bit, Facebook is still going to have the newsfeed. They're still going to collect your data. They're still going to build their advertising business off of collected data. He's just creating more spaces for people to speak without the possibility of being watched by anyone, which we have seen has already caused problems for Facebook, notably with WhatsApp. WhatsApp right. is already end-to-end encrypted. And in certain countries, the misinformation that is spread on WhatsApp has directly led to violence. I mean, in India, they were even called WhatsApp lynchings based on misinformation that came out and spread via the platform. So they're trying to figure out how to have that while still protecting their users. It is a very difficult problem, and I don't envy them.
Well, and one thing you very rightly point out to wrap it up is that critics are concerned that Facebook ultimately is trying to fix the perception of its problems rather than the root causes.
You know, they could be spending more on the content moderation efforts. They could be ramping up their resources in this area. And, you know, the pattern shows that they've really only responded to things when they've bubbled up to the surface and become a public issue. And that may just be because there are too many fires to put out, but it may also be because what they care about most is having this perception that they're a good mission-based company. And if there's anything that alters that, then that's their top priority.
That's Sarah Friar. And again, Facebook, you know, I feel like over the last year or two that they have been working on their content, policing its content, but it's not so easy to clean up.
Well, and as Sarah notes, and as we chatted about with her, this comes on the heels of Mark Zuckerberg really starting to think about what Facebook should be. Really interesting conversation there.
So what Moneyball did for baseball, Action Network is hoping to do for sports betting overall, including the office pool.
I love this story because it's so well-timed on the eve of March Madness. Mm-hmm. Everyone's obsessed with it. And yet, it potentially could get a lot more serious this year, given what the Supreme Court said last year. Ira Boudway breaks it all down for us in this week's edition. He's here with us in New York. So, Ira, these guys, this is good timing.
Yeah. And it was not an accident. So the Supreme Court ruling that made it possible for more states to legalize sports betting came down last May, but you could see it coming when the court agreed to hear the case. So around that time, this Chernin Group, a private equity investment firm.
Peter Chernin, formerly of
Fox News. They rolled together some smaller companies that were serving daily fantasy players and people who were already betting in, you know, the gray and black markets, and started the Action Network, which the idea was not to be a betting operator, but to be, you know, the way they put it honestly is the Bloomberg of betting, where they're giving you all the data and tools you need to be a smart bettor.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
That's a compliment. But it is all about data. And increasingly, we see data analytics being used to pick players, to figure out strategies. Tell us about kind of the strategy for Action Network, because they've got a couple of tiers and how they're hoping to bring in people.
Yeah, it starts with a media company where they're writing stories. Here's the line for the game this weekend. Here's where the smart money's going. Here's a funny thing that happened in a bettor, you know, won a huge payout. And that's to get you in, to get familiar with betting, download their app, and then they have a whole series of paid services that get more and more sophisticated. So you can get just basic data about where the money is in a given bet and some expert picks for $8 a month. For $50 a month, you can start trying to become a system bettor where you build these, you filter through decades of data and look at, say, I think that NFL teams underperform when it's windy against the spread, or the home team after a bye week is, you know, does better. And you can actually test those theories out and see if they do in fact bear out historically. And then you can try to find ways to bet that system. That's like $50 a month. Then you can, for $250 a month, look at really granular data about how betting markets are moving all over the world. But so they're trying to basically be the one-stop shop for anybody from the casual to the really serious bettor who just wants to read about it or really wants to, you know, maybe bet for a living.
And we mentioned Chernin, obviously a well-known name. There are a couple other well-known names who've been recruited into this, not the least of which is Darren Revelle, a familiar name to lots of folks out there, covered the business of sports. He has 2 million Twitter followers, widely followed, clearly. What's his role in all this?
Basically, they are trying to gain awareness right now to the brand and bring people in, and he is the top of that funnel. So they hired people who have big followings. He's probably the biggest name among them in the world of sports and sports betting and sports business, to basically sort of grab those 2 million followers and say, hey, here's the thing, the Action Network, here's stories we're doing, and then, hey, you might want to buy this $8 service. So he's there to basically report out every little thing he sees in that market and keep keep the name in the news.
Ira, what's the challenge? Because I think about even, you know, everywhere, office pools, certainly when it comes to March Madness, you just see it. You see it with fantasy football. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of folks who play. But what's it take to get that casual better than to actually sign up for a monthly subscription? How tough is that?
I think, you know, they are working on that right now, that science of that trick. And one of the things they say that works really well for them is if they can get you to enter one bet into their little bet tracking software so that you say, like, I bet on the Warriors to win tonight, beat the spread. And you put in what you bet. And then as you're watching the game, as the score changes, it shows you the probability of your win paying out. And if people do that, they say then they'll sign up for the paid services. Mm-hmm. Then they'll go on from there. So it's just kind of getting hooked on that experience of experiencing a game through the prism of betting and kind of making every game matter a little bit more and having that minute to minute, like, am I going to win this bet experience?
All right. So I feel like we're at that exciting moment of the year for a sports fan. You know, we've come through the sort of dark winter post NFL, sort of the early stages of the NBA and the NCAA season. March Madness, we've talked about, but also spring training. Mm-hmm. We're in the throes of it. We're not far from opening day.
Right.
Major League Baseball, I have to say, I'm a baseball fan. My kids are not. And part of the reason is it's a bit of a slow game, but also the economics of it, not that this is what my kids are interested in, but as I take a step back, the economics are pretty tortured for baseball right now.
Yeah, they have a real problem with free agency, and it's kind of grinding to a halt. And they've had this system in place for a really long time where you basically are locked in to your team and into a really controlled rate of pay for your first 6 years as a Major League Baseball player on a Major League roster. They can pay basically like $500,000 a year. You know,
which in the world of sports is effectively nothing.
Right. It's a huge bargain if you perform at all. And it goes up from there, but it's not very much. And then the deal has kind of always been that if you can be a standout player after your sixth year, you're going to cash in. You're going to get a long-term deal for maybe hundreds of millions, but certainly tens of millions of dollars. And that's going to be your payout for the years that you were giving teams all this production for not very much money. But what's happened is basically owners and teams are kind of looking at that back end and saying that we're wasting money there and we don't want to do that anymore. Like, our analytics are showing us that it's not worth it to be paying guys when they're 35 years old, you know, $15 million a year, and we're not going to do it anymore. We're not going to offer those long-term deals. And players are saying, well, hey, that was kind of the deal here. You underpay us and then you overpay us, and this is not working for us.
That's reporter Ira Boudouet-Carroll, and it was great to talk to him because he had that double shot in the magazine this week. March Madness, obviously, on everybody's mind, but also spring training.
So, Jason, we see lots of trends going on around the world. We have pushback against globalization, protectionism, so on. One trend going on over in Europe, it's not a great one, and it has to do with bank scandals.
It's money laundering. Money makes the world go round, and this is something that has been happening for a long time, and yet it seems to be coming to the fore more and more. Alan Katz joins us from Paris with the story. You do such a nice job of synthesizing everything that's happened and all this acceleration over the past year or so. What catalyzed this new attention?
Well, there are two things, really. One of them, surprisingly, was the Russian attack on Sergei Skripal, a former Russian agent who'd been living in the UK. And the reason it made a difference was that for the first time, Europeans sort of felt that Russian actions might actually be harmful to them. Again, this had nothing to do with money laundering, actually. It was, you know, a Russian attack on a former agent, but it was with a chemical agent that made the Skripal and his daughter Yulia violently ill, sent them to the hospital, killed a woman whose boyfriend had accidentally found a perfume bottle that contained this agent. And it really personalized Russian actions. And so it made people, I think, in Europe a little warier of Russia and its intentions toward them than they'd been before. The U.S., of course, has a long history of viewing Russia as its enemy. And so Americans tend to think, I would say more naturally, that maybe Russians have bad intentions towards Americans. Europeans don't always feel the same way, and the Skripal attack really made that difference. The other thing that changed really was the Danske Bank money laundering affair, and particularly in September 2019, when Danske actually reported the full scope of that, which is around $230 billion, that they moved through this tiny unit that they had in Estonia, which is itself a tiny country that used to be a Soviet state. And that size of that really sort of shocked a lot of Europeans, particularly a lot of Scandinavians, who viewed their region as, you know, very clean, very very not corrupt. And the rest of the world views Scandinavia the same way. So I think it was that much money moved through a Danish bank was really surprising to a lot of people and really caught their attention.
Well, because then it goes to Swedbank, then it goes to Nordea. So you sort of have this domino effect of sorts and people really looking much more deeply at the activities of some very well-known and, as you say, well-regarded European banks.
That's exactly right. And to step back for a minute, the Russian money was going through the Baltics, which is Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. These are former Soviet states. Most of them have big Russian-speaking populations. There's a lot of cultural connections with them. The Scandinavian banks, the ones from Finland, Sweden, and Denmark, came in and bought a lot of these Baltic banks. So they sort of bought their way in to these former Soviet states. That said, when they bought them, they bought all the issues that these banks had already had in terms of moving Russian money, and they didn't appear to do much about it. I mean, Danske bought a bank called Sampo, which then became Danske Estonia, back in 2007. And for years, it just let the Russian money roll through in ever greater amounts. And so they bought into this issue. But on the other hand, they had plenty of time to do something about it, and they chose not to. So it really was a cascade effect. And again, Danske appears to be sort of the biggest hub of this, but Nordea and Swedbank, and who knows if there are others to come, who also might have been involved with it, because really all the money sloshing through the Baltic units of these Scandinavian banks were linking to each other.
What's interesting, Alan, and take a step back, you go through the history over the last, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years, that it wasn't like everybody seemed almost okay with so much Russian money in particular, whether it was flowing through the UK, whether it was going through Switzerland, whether it was going through Cyprus. And what's interesting is, right, we talk about how it fueled real estate in New York, in London. It bought what, the Chelsea Football Club? Like everybody seemed to be okay. But with the Skripal incident and the poisoning, all of a sudden it became a security issue, and everybody realized, wait, this is a different type of threat and concern.
It did, and you're absolutely right about that. It really personalized it for a lot of people. Don't forget, so the first point when Russians or Russian money became less wanted was after Russia invaded Crimea in 2014, and the U.S. and the European Union imposed sanctions on a series of Russian individuals and Russian companies, and to a lesser extent on some Russian banks and some Russian companies. So that was the first point when Russian money, at least from a legal and political perspective, became more suspect. Until then, everyone was happy to have Russian money. And in fact, it was seen more as an advantage to the West and a problem for Russia, but definitely not a problem for the West. Starting in 2014, it started to be a problem. And again, more in the U.S. than in Europe. And then in Europe, with Skripal, it suddenly became, well, it's not just Russian money that's the problem. Russia might be acting in a way that we don't really like, and therefore we are more nervous about these Russians and their money.
So you asked the question, why can't the European Union police itself? Talk to us a little bit about the policing, regulators' oversight, because we are seeing bigger fines being put on some of these banks in the European region. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, those bigger fines, that's very recent. There was one in France that was actually through a court case where the court fined UBS $5.1 billion for engaging in money laundering and helping French people engage in tax evasion. But that's that was just a few weeks ago, and it really was a landmark case. It was the first time you've had that level of fine really anywhere in Europe for money laundering offenses. Traditionally, regulators have gone after banks for violating money laundering laws, but the fines have been in the millions, maybe the tens of millions. They've been so small as to really not be much of a deterrent. And one of the reasons for this is that Europe has directives that go across the region on how to deal with money laundering. Those directives are then translated into national rules and regulations. And so each country can decide more or less how aggressively it wants to go after money laundering or not. And so if a country goes after money laundering aggressively, well, if you are laundering the money, you don't have to go to that country. You don't have to have your money in a bank in France or a bank in Germany or a bank in Spain or a bank in the UK. You can pick and choose. Maybe you want it in France because the French don't look carefully at money from your particular country. Or maybe you want it in Liechtenstein, or they're not in the EU, but in Luxembourg, because they don't look very carefully at money coming from your particular country. Or in the case of Russians, you wanted it through Cyprus or through the Baltics because they didn't look very carefully. And once it went through there, well, then you could send it through shell companies to banks in France or in the UK or in Germany or in the US or anywhere else you wanted to, because by that point, the money had become too difficult to follow. And so that's been one of Europe's major problems, has been this sort of patchwork system for actually enforcing money laundering controls.
Right.
And they're trying to have better cooperation, but it's difficult.
That's reporter Alan Katz joining us from Paris, reminding us, Jason, that money laundering, it's been a problem in Europe for a long time.
That's exactly right. It's something that really was hiding in plain sight.
It's time for another edition of Business Week Talks. With us is Glenn Fogel, Booking Holdings CEO and president, of course, home to such well-known brands as Priceline, Booking.com, Kayak, and more. And Glenn, I've got to say, I feel like it's an interesting time because there's so much going on. And just recently, we know that we had Airbnb buying Hotel Tonight. And I'm curious because they tried to make a bigger presence in the boutique hotel business and the bed and breakfast space. What does it mean for you? What are the implications?
Well, it didn't surprise me. We've been talking about one of our great advantages, that you can come to our site and you can see a hotel or you can get a home, an apartment, whatever you want, look at one place. So for them to copy us and basically start expanding out into the hotel area too. Well, I see it's flattery. And look, it's great. I know the CEO over at Hotel Tonight. I'm happy for him. Nice place to find a place to park the company. Good for them. For us, though, we still think we have a better product.
And so how has that changed the mix? Because obviously Airbnb, VRBO, and the other home rental sites, I feel like, you know, we talk about it all the time. It's become sort of a go-to choice for a lot of people. How does that change the mix? How is the revenue, how's the profitability different as you introduce that more robustly into the product set?
So we were pretty happy in our earnings call just 2 weeks ago. We announced for the first time that we did $2.8 billion of revenue in that area. In one quarter, the third quarter, we did over $1 billion. So it's growing, and we like that. It's as profitable in terms of the take rate, what you take from the host and a commission type thing. It's a little bit more expensive, though, to run because you can't scale all of your costs across a very large property. So you have to deal with individual property owners. That's a little more costly. End of the day, though, it's all incremental.
Glenn, what's the upside, what's the downside, though, to it becoming a much more competitive space?
Well, you know, obviously everybody likes to have a world where you are the only player in it. Unfortunately, that's not it. Travel is such an enormous business, $2 trillion, maybe more in terms of total amount of sales and travel around the world. Big opportunity for everybody. We're glad to be the biggest player there by far. We love the fact that there's a lot of opportunity left for us. We only do 9% of the total hotel rooms are in our own space. That's a lot of opportunity under 9%.
But what kind of strategy changes do you have to do as the competition gets tougher?
Well, you always have to provide more value. That's the thing. You've got to provide more value both to the customer who's going to be traveling and the other side of the equation, which is the host or the supplier or hotel owner. And the way you do that is using technology. That's one of the things we are built on, technology, going out, getting really, really smart people, AI specialists, people who can understand the data, so you can come up with a better solution for both sides of that marketplace.
So let's talk about your brands, because you've got some well-known brands, but you've got multiples. You got Priceline, you have Kayak, you have Agoda. How do you sort of manage that portfolio going forward? Do a couple of the brands become more dominant? How do you see that evolving?
Well, Booking.com is by far our biggest brand, but every single one of them is very important to the success of the company. Now, we have been bringing a couple of them closer together. So a year ago in December, we brought together Rentalcars.com and Booking.com because we know how important it is for a customer who's going to be going anywhere. You need ground transportation along with a hotel. You got to be able to do that. On the other side, we brought together the area of OpenTable and Kayak together, not so much because when you're looking, searching for a flight that you need a restaurant, but because the technologists there are just super smart. We want to be able to share that ability across both platforms.
Got to ask you about Google and Facebook, because I think about when I'm starting to travel, the first thing I do is I go on Google, right? And I search around and I start looking for things. Are they the ultimate competitors? Do you watch what they're doing? Because they have access to so many people, so much information.
I don't think anybody can go to sleep and not be concerned about what will Google do next or Facebook do next or Amazon do next. And that's just in the U.S. So you've got Alibaba. Mm-hmm. You've got the people over at Tencent. You've got Baidu. Lots of really big technology-oriented people who, if they wanted to, perhaps could do something. The fact is, though, it's a lot harder than you think. You know, we have thousands of people every day who are calling on hotels to make sure we're getting the best prices for our customer and working those relationships. That's not just technology. That's boots on the ground. That's an advantage.
You've been at this company almost two decades, more than mm-hmm. two decades. How has the travel business changed? How has running essentially a travel services business changed during that time period?
You know, I was thinking about that, how much things have changed in the one sense of technology, because I remember we started off when you're on AOL dial-up and trying to connect and trying to buy something. Oh, my God.
I remember travel agents, not to date myself or anything, but...
Well, there still are travel agents,
that's
right?
True.
Less so. And that's one of the things, though, now when you can use your phone... That mobile central thing to do everything, what a difference that it makes things so easier. But it's not as easy as it should be. Think about all the troubles you've had traveling. Think about all the problems of booking something, and then something goes wrong, and how do you fix it? And the fact that you have to enter your credit card several times. We are building a frictionless solution. That's what we want at the end of the day, is that you just have to do it once, and it's done. And if anything goes wrong, there's somebody who knows everything that happened can fix it. And when you use AI, it's figure out where that problem is before it even happens and make corrections or suggest those corrections to you before it happens.
That's the CEO of Booking Holdings, Glenn Fogel. And Carol, this is the kickoff of a new series, Business Week Talks, chatting with some of the most influential CEOs, and very timely with Glenn Fogel because a big deal in the hospitality space, and it's fast moving.
Right. It's our opportunity to get beyond the quarterly earnings reports, really talk about company strategy. And that's exactly what we did with Glenn.
So we get a double dose of James Tarmy this week in Pursuits for those looking for things to do this spring. He's got to look at culture's colossal new wave.
He does. But the section opens with a really cool photo of a new museum. Tell us about it.
It's the National Museum of Qatar, and it's designed by the French architect Jean Nouvel. And it is probably the most important museum to open in decades in terms of its actual architecture. It's been in the works for at least 8 years, and it's this spectacular several hundred thousand square foot real kind of masterpiece, which is opening later this month. And it's a big deal.
And same architect who designed the Louvre in Abu Dhabi, is
yes.
that right?
So two museums in the region designed by the same architect. And they both are pretty architecturally distinct, but this one in Qatar is one for the books, I think.
And it looks gorgeous. It's supposed to look like a plant flower?
It is supposed to look like a sand rose or desert rose, which is a naturally occurring crystal formation that occurs in arid regions close to water. And they're actually quite beautiful. They really do look like flowers, except they're crystals.
All right. So check that out. But you, what's wonderful about Pursuits this week is that you really highlight art, music.
You tell us what to do.
Events.
We love it.
Things that are happening this spring.
All over the world. And there's a ton happening. So like most programming, it takes years and years and years to actually get these things into motion. And so what we're looking at now is the culmination of 5, sometimes even 10 years worth of planning. There are incredible museum shows. There are incredible concerts. For instance, the Ojai Music Festival, which is this very famous festival in a little vacation town north of Los Angeles, is having Barbara Hannigan, who's a superstar singer and also a conductor, kind of doing this culmination of its leader's 20-year anniversary. It's a pretty big thing. And there's also some really exciting theater happening as well.
Tell us about that.
I'm most interested in what's coming to a new cultural institution in New York, which we can get to in a little bit, called The Shed. The poet and classicist Anne Carson, who's a bit of a superstar among a certain literary section of the population, has written a new play. And starring in it is Renee Fleming, the opera singer, and Ben Whishaw, the actor. And it's partly sung, partly spoken, totally new and a totally new commission from the Shed, which is going to be doing a lot more of this, actually.
It's on the lives of, is this right, Marilyn Monroe and Helen of Troy?
Yes.
Oh, my God. That just sounds like it's wild.
Yes. And people are really excited about it. You know, tickets have been on sale for a very short period of time, and there are very few left.
Right. And when it comes to those rainy spring days where you just have to curl up and read a book, you can't be out and about, or you don't want to be out and about, what should we be reading?
So I focused on art-related books, art and architecture-related books. One of the books that I'm most excited about...
So these are the ones that Carol lounges on her couch and just flips through because they're so beautiful.
Yes, yes. That's exactly right.
The vase on top.
A tablescape.
Yes, exactly. Well done, Mr.
Thank you. It's almost like it's my job. So this is the 100-year anniversary of the founding of the Bauhaus School of Design. And the Bauhaus in Weimar and Dessau was this school that brought us people like Walter Gropius and many other designers who have now shaped what we understand to be mid-century design. There are a lot of things that are going on to celebrate this, including a book that's coming out about Bauhaus's spread throughout the world and the kind of Western part of Europe and the United States.
That happens to be the Business Week pick, by the way, right?
It does indeed.
All right. So the National Museum of Qatar, we go see that, and then we go see the Shed, and then we go to Vegas, right? That's the next stop. You got to talk about this other story you have in Pursuits.
This is... truly over the top story. And it involves two of Las Vegas's wealthiest people, the Fertitta brothers, Frank and Lorenzo Fertitta, who own Red Rock Resorts, which in turn owns Station Casinos, which in turn has spent more than $600 million redeveloping the Palms casino and resort. And the Fertittas spend a ton of money not only on redevelopment, but they also spend a lot of money on art. And they are famous for collecting Basquiat and Warhol and many other very, very big name people. And one of those people who they have spent a lot of time collecting is the artist Damien Hirst, who is a contemporary artist probably best known for his formaldehyde sharks and other animals in tanks. They commissioned Damien Hirst, among other things, to do a bar. They put a lot of his art in the hotel. But then they have also just announced that they hired Damien Hirst to redo an 2-floor, 9,000-square-foot high roller suite.
Wow.
Yes.
So you can really sleep with the fishes.
Well, you can sleep with the sharks.
Okay. Right.
And there are... So Hirst, they put 6 of Hirst's artwork into the suite, but then they also commissioned Hirst to do all of the decoration. So there is Hirst embroidery on the pillows. There's Hirst curtains, Hirst wallpaper,
Hirst butterflies
over everything. Yeah. Yes.
Wow.
And
butterflies.
Yes. And so the price of staying in a Hirst conceived space is $100,000 a night, or it's provided gratis to high rollers with $1 million or up line of credit at the casino.
Once again, Carol Masser.
Once again, I was going to say James Tarmey.
There we go.
Yes.
James Tarmey, always a treat to catch up with you.
Fun.
You're all over the world bringing it to us here in New York. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
So with a title like this, you know we're going to have fun. It's about cars. It's about luxury vehicles. It's about the backseat. And oh, the title of the story is The Rear Rules.
Yeah, I couldn't even figure out the best way to get into this.
Be careful here.
Except that we do know that the ultimate luxury is never really driving in the front seat or riding in the passenger seat. It's the backseat. And wow, Hannah Elliott is here. She's been in all of these backseats, testing them out. What's going on back there?
A lot's going on. I mean, imagine like private jet travel on 4 wheels. That's basically what these automakers are going for. And that's kind of what you find.
So you got to test out all of these. Yeah. And let's kind of go through them because it's so much fun to read through. The Rolls-Royce Phantom.
Yes.
Extended wheelbase.
Extended wheelbase. So
that's important, right? Because it gives you more room.
9 more inches
over the regular Phantom, which is already a massive car. So this adds another 9 inches, which of course makes room for things like champagne coolers, massagers, footrests covered in lamb's wool. You can put in cases to store your watches, cigar humidors, lots of fun things like that.
You actually said it's two thrones.
Exactly.
I mean, is it
two? Two separate seats that recline pretty much fully, that have monogram pillows, all leather, 10-inch, over 10-inch touchscreens for each one, Bluetooth headsets, the whole thing.
Honey, this is you're watching Billions and I'm watching whatever, Outlander.
This is a $525,000 car.
Base price, yes. Wow. And we can expect everything. When I ask Rolls-Royce, they say over 90% of the Phantoms they sell are heavily bespoke, which means that this little $525,000 number is kind of a suggestion.
All right, so let's go a little bit down market to the Lexus.
Sure, yes.
Which isn't, you know, doesn't have all of necessarily the bells and whistles, but you point out that the appointments and the leather are pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's probably the least expensive car on this list, but for the price, you actually get a lot. And I wanted to really call out that there's a wide variety of price ranges. The Lexus is very well thought out. So while it doesn't have the champagne coolers and the lamb's wool, everything and the wood that the Phantom does, it's very well thought out. It's a very good use of space. The seats also tilt back to a 48-degree angle, which is great. Everything is just really well thought out. And again, it's big. So for the money, it's a great backseat.
I love it. You call it a 70-mile-per-hour hotel room.
Yeah.
Because of the...
Yes, exactly. And the whole thing about these is you can use them to work, to sleep. It's an extension of your day.
Going upmarket again, the BMW. Talk about this one. It's a very specific one. And I like that it's got a vitality program.
Exactly. So this is the M760i. Not to be confused with the M line of BMWs. This is the 7 Series. And yes, the vitality exercises. And I did go through the whole program. It's special things like rolling your shoulders back, turning your neck. And
you're
great.
You just have to ride around and run before the show. That would be great for you.
Exactly. That would be really great. But there's a mist, right?
There's an air atomizer that has different fragrances that you can pair with the Vitality program. It's all very zen.
I would live in my car.
Yes. And let's not forget, this BMW can beat a Corvette off the line. So this is no slouch at all. It's a fast car and relaxing.
That's Hannah Elliott. We always say to her, you've got the best job. But this was really a fun one. She wasn't behind the wheel. She was in the back seat.
Right. And the details that she brought us, it really reminds you that luxury, it is everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. And can be very much customized.
And that wraps up Bloomberg Business Week's weekend podcast. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jason Kelly.
And I'm Carol Masser. Be sure to tune in to Bloomberg Business Week Radio live Monday through Friday, starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time.
And if you can't catch us live, get our daily podcast. Subscribe at iTunes, SoundCloud, and Bloomberg.com.
You can get this week's edition of the magazine. Just check out newsstands right now.
We'll be back next week at the same time.
This is Bloomberg.